Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to It's Rainmaking Time. This is Kim Greenhouse. Thank you for being here. Many times I ask myself, what happened at Katrina? Who was there? Who was actually on the grounds when this terrible emergency, horrific event happened? And a few years ago, I was in an art gallery and I met Alistar McKenna, filmmaker, writer, producer, advocate of many things, who's on a 10,000-mile adventure that begins in April called Road to Sturgis. She is the producer, writer, and director of Peacekeepers, which you'll hear a lot about and see a lot about. And I asked her if she would come here today to share with us her experience of what it was like to be in Katrina 5 days after. Please welcome to It's Rainmaking Time, Alistar McKenna.
Hi.
Thanks for being here.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
The first thing that struck me that was fascinating about you was your sharing with me your experience of being in Katrina 5 days after, mm-hmm. and all the pictures you have and all the documentation you took and your live experience on the ground there with the people, with the emergency teams. I'd like you to share with us what that was like, because I don't think most of us have a real glimpse into what an emergency disaster condition is like.
It's like being on a film set.
Seriously. That's
scary. It's like being on a sci-fi film set. Everything is torn up. Everything is disarray. You know, when I actually was watching it on television, and I saw a film crew pass by a house. They were in a boat. And a dog came out on the roof and started barking at them. And I thought, okay, get the shot, pick up the dog. Get the shot, pick up the dog. They didn't pick up the dog. I was very mad. And I was stomping and pacing in front of my television. And my boyfriend said, why don't you go help? That's what you do. Go. So I packed up my motorcycle and I went. And I ride a Harley, Harley Davidson Heritage Softail. And I drove to New Orleans. I live in Los Angeles. And when I got there, I drove through 40 miles of backed up traffic on the freeway. Thank God I was on a motorcycle, because I just lane split right through the middle of them. The army, the telephone company, you know, semi trucks with food, with water, all the things. I just went right through, went to a police station, went in there and I said, listen, the first guy I saw, listen, I came to help. He said, well, I don't know what to do with you. I said, well, does somebody need help? Do you need, obviously you need something, because everything, I'm telling you, for miles before I got there, everything was a mess. There were boats, big, large boats, not little boats, boats in the middle of the freeway. There were trees that were torn up and laying on their sides, and they had pulled up all of the ground around them. So when you walked past them, it was like walking past a mountain of it was dirt and their whole root system. Unbelievable stuff. Every sign was gone. Every roof was gone. I saw an entire roof of a house in a tree that was still, the tree was still standing. And up on the tree was the roof, way up in the air. Anyhow, I told him I was going to go sit down. You figure it out. I'm going to go sit over there. And a few minutes later, a woman came in and said she needed help with a bird. She had a seabird in her front yard. So I said, I'm the girl for you. I went with her. And thank God, this woman was a tour guide for the city of New Orleans. Because once we dealt with her bird, we went to Pass Christian, Mississippi, which is right next to New Orleans.
About how many miles away, do you know, or how long by time?
I'm going to say, maybe 25, 30 miles. Okay. And it was destroyed. It was completely gone. And there were just piles of houses and animals running everywhere. And when we got to the gate, she told the guy, the army guy, listen, she's here to rescue animals. So they just turned me loose. Me and my motorcycle. I lived on top of that motorcycle. The army brought me two boxes of MREs, which is military food. And
by the way, how was it?
It was good.
How do you cook military food?
Well, I didn't. No, you don't. I mean, because it's ready to go. You can warm it up.
Like cornflakes or what are we talking about?
There's pasta. There's lasagna. There's these wonderful. Just mixed meals, fettuccine, all kinds of good stuff.
Wow.
Yeah, I could actually put it on my motorcycle, heat it up, On my pipes. And I'd have warm food.
Did you say pipes?
Yeah, well, yeah, my motorcycle pipes.
That's how you heat food?
Yeah.
I've heard it all now. I've heard it all. I'm going to bake bread on my top of my car.
But there wasn't anything. I mean, there was nothing. The military had cots laying next to me. We were actually located at this little gas station that was no longer a gas station on a corner. The only clear spot in the area. Military was there. The trucks would come in there. And, and I parked my motorcycle there. I slept on top of her, warmed up my MREs. And it was good. It was like camping in a war zone.
Were people crying? Were people lost looking? Were they forlorn? I mean, what was your experience?
They were shocked. The people that actually lived there were shocked. There were people still living on their porches because obviously they couldn't enter their houses. Everything had fallen inside their houses, right? And it almost looked like somebody had picked up their house, shook it, and then set it back down, if it was even on the same property. There were houses that had floated into the street and were sitting in the middle of streets, especially in the Ninth Ward. The first people I saw, actually the military came and got me and said there was a guy living on his porch. No, this is 5 days after. This was the first day I got there. I arrived. He was living on his porch, wouldn't go anywhere without his dogs because his dogs had saved his life and his mother and father's. And so they told me where to go. They couldn't take me, but they told me where to go. And I got over there. And fortunately, my motorcycle was one of the only vehicles that could actually get through this massive tangle of houses and cars and stuff. I got there. I doctored his dog. And he only had a pair of pajamas on, no shoes, no nothing. He couldn't actually walk away from it. And so I put him on my motorcycle. I took him over. I got him some MREs. I took him over to another spot outside of the pass, is what they call it, outside of the pass. And he got some actual clothing, took a shower, got some medication for himself because everybody had odd skin issues there that had been in that water. And this guy had spent, in the morning is when his dogs woke him up. He went and looked at the window, and it was already halfway to the window of his house. So he ran and woke his parents up, and they got them upstairs, into the attic. The water then broke through and came up, and they ended up busting a hole in the roof of the house and staying on the roof for, I think, 11 hours. And his mother and dad are very old. And they were getting really cold. And so they sort of tucked them under the back inside the house because the water was
dissipating
into the attic. No, it was into the attic, but it hadn't gone up into the very top. So he had tucked his mom and his dad in there, and they had stayed there for so long. They were just frozen. His mom was in this little nightie. You know, I think the mom and dad were, I'm going to say, mid 70s. But, then when the water went down, they went down too, and they had stayed there. I mean, they had to wait for somebody to come rescue them because there was nowhere to go, no place to go, no vehicles, no roads, no houses.
Was it all flooded?
Yeah, it was all flooded. Yeah. And once the water went back to the ocean, because this is not the Ninth Ward. This is past Christian. This was a surge from the ocean. This wasn't the dam breaking, you know? Anyhow, I took him on my motorcycle, and we got the stuff. We got clothing, and I took him back. And, you know, when they started evacuating people, they wouldn't evacuate the animals.
I never understood that. Well, I mean, how can people leave their animals behind? I mean, emotionally, I don't see people being able to do that.
A lot of people didn't. A lot of people stayed on those porches, lived with those animals until help came. Yeah.
Wow.
Because I know when I was there for a couple of months, and I went down to, when I was done at Pass Christian, I went down to the Ninth Ward and connected with some people at emergency communities. And emergency communities, I don't know what the foundation is like, but in this camp, it was just a bunch of hippies. you know, tents and hippies and people just trying to do the right thing. And they had it all set up in these big tents. They had a feeding center or a tent that you could come and eat three meals a day there. We would, for all the people living on the Ninth Ward that couldn't leave because they had no place to go or no way to get there, they would come, we would change out their clothes, give them new clothes, and then wash their clothes. We had a little media tent so that you could actually, once they got the internet and everything up, you could actually, you know, send messages out. We lent boards. We went and helped people pick through their homes and get the stuff that they could find. It was a pretty wonderful thing. We gave massages.
That's terrific.
You know, doctored people. The military or the government brought in some refrigerated trucks with food and water for these people. So that's where we got our food and water. And for the most part, everybody lived in a pup tent. I lived on top of my bike. I was fortunate. But most of them lived in pup tents, those little tents from when you were Boy Scouts, the little ones. And then there were a few that looked like teepees.
Wow.
So, but, you know, everybody threw in. I have to tell you, I was really frustrated with the news reports. Because,
talk about that.
Well, it was about looters and bad guys and on shootings. And I'm sure, you know, you get a bunch of people that are absolutely desperate
and traumatized.
And traumatized and lost and angry, and there's no help coming, or you don't feel like there's any help coming, and you can't really see. You forget that outside of this city, regular life is continuing on. So you get a little crazy, but I didn't see those people. I saw people coming to help. I saw people that had lost their homes, bending over backwards to help the other guy. I saw a lot of really people
chipping
invested,
in, stepping up.
Yes,
and
in their community and their people. So I'm sure that stuff went on. You know, obviously it did, but by comparison,
it was nothing.
That wasn't the real of the situation. And I have to tell you, the massive devastation of this area, and it wasn't just this town, it was every town along the coast, and it wasn't a few houses, like, if, you know, we get fires here, we'll get some communities that all burn down. No, if you were the size of LA, and every single home, every single telephone pole, every bit of
infrastructure
is completely wiped out. It would take a really long time to absolutely be able to fix this. I can tell you the people that came in to rescue were like, holy crap. You know, it wasn't like, oh my God, let me get that one. It's every single one. I have pictures of houses that had floated into other yards or down the street. In the Ninth Ward, there were three houses in the middle of an intersection. God only knows where they came from. There was a house that looked like it was on a foundation, and underneath this house, flipped upside down, sitting on the front porch was a car. And that house didn't start out there. That house was the neighbor's house. There were refrigerators on top of anything like that. Refrigerators, trash compactors, things like that were sitting on roofs. But the roofs, it was so high. The water was so unbelievably high. Unless you had a brick foundation or a brick house, your house was someplace else. And vehicles and trash and everything in those homes.
What about plumbing and everything? People need to go to the bathroom. What happened?
There was no place. You know, they brought the trailers, these FEMA trailers. And even 9 months later, when I was there, because I kept returning, they were still sitting in the same lots. And the truth is that there was no place to get them to. There was no electricity. There was no place. The roads weren't clear enough that you could actually put a trailer in there, drive to it and put it in there, and get it hooked up with electricity. All the phone... I have a wonderful picture in the Ninth Ward of all a long road, with a row of telephone poles, and they're all leaning on the ground. And all the utility poles were doing the same thing. There were wires. It looked like somebody had hung their wash on all the wires. And it smelled like death. Unbelievable. There were also a lot of animals, dead animals. And by that time I got there, they were all covered with maggots. So what you'd walk by is an outline of an animal, but it was just white worms all over it.
How terrible.
It was horrendous. And that was everything. That wasn't, you know, you couldn't step into another block and it'd be better. It was miles and miles of devastation. But I really did see a lot of heroes, just regular heroes, you know.
What was your experience of law enforcement, of FEMA, of the people that
I didn't see FEMA.
Were facilitating?
I didn't see FEMA. I saw that in the past, Christian, I could see where they had come through because the houses were marked. You know, they mark how many dead, how many alive, that sort of thing on all of the houses. But I never saw FEMA. I can't even imagine. I know they went through, but again, I'll tell you an interesting story. I have a friend who is a vet. It's her name is Rachel Jones. She's Quincy Jones's daughter, and I worked a lot with her. And so when I got there, I had all kinds of meds and stuff, not pill forms, but you know, wrappings and stuff to deal with the animals. And so when I got there, I was the animal expert on call, right? And I went around, and there were like the police would come to me or the fire department would come to me walking in a troop. They'd say, "Listen, Al, you know, there's a dog over here, there's a cat over there, and if I could zip them into my tea bags on my motorcycle, I would take them out and hand them over to a vet or something. But if I couldn't, then I would just, you know, feed them every single day and make sure they had water." And the animals were exactly like the people, very stressed out, very much in shock. I had dogs I couldn't touch or go near because they were barking at me or I couldn't get them out from underneath cars, but I'd still put food there. And eventually, you know, usually there was this one couple. It was a German Shepherd, a female German Shepherd, and a yellow lab. And the yellow lab, something had split his head open so that I could actually see his eyeball moving.
I'm going to faint.
But I couldn't catch the dog. It took me 5 days to be able to get them to come to me. And they were always hindering the police or the fire department when they would come by because this female was very protective of this golden retriever. And she would just like, make sure everybody stayed right. Rawr, you know, and they're like, "Oh God, Al, come get these dogs." Well, I couldn't, you know, I couldn't capture them. And the other thing is I didn't have leads or anything. I was walking around picking up leashes, pieces of rope. I have found quite a few actual, what do you call those things? Crates, you know, that people had empty crates. And the first guy that I went to that had the dog that was living on his porch, he helped me take care of these animals. So what would happen was I sort of had a map of where all these animals were. And if I could bring them to his house, I would. And he had this little gated area and we put them in there. And if not, I had, you know, I would visit every day and feed them and water them and just try to coax them out, right? FEMA came about, I'm going to say 5 days or 6 days after I got there. And I was over at the police trailer and I saw them drive up, beautiful white truck. These women had these blue, beautiful, it said FEMA vet. They were clean. They were nice. They looked like paratroopers. God damn, they were good looking. You know, their hair was done. Their makeup was done. Now you got to know, I've already been sleeping on my motorcycle. Forget the trip. I've been sleeping for almost 2 weeks on my motorcycle, okay? And
God,
I'm burnt and I'm tired and we're all looking like this, okay? We're looking bad. And the woman, I see the chief, he points over at me. And so the woman comes over and says, "Are you the vet on call?" I said, "Uh-oh, I'm busted." "Yes."
Oh my God.
And she said, "Well, listen." And she rolled out this paper. She said, "I came, I need this address. There's a woman there. She has, I forget how many, but like 20 Yorkshire Terriers. And we came to check up on these animals." I said, "Well, the house isn't there anymore. There's actually nothing on that street right now." And she said, "Well, can you take me there?" I said, "Well, yeah, I can. But listen, I have my list." And I have a list. "I have this animal and this animal." She said, "We're not here for that." I said, "What?" She said, "We're here just specifically to check on these animals." I said, "Are you out of your frickin' mind? I have been here dealing with these animals. I have these animals. You need to take them. I have a dog whose head's split open. I have a dog who has a broken leg. I have a dog that's so freaking cut that I did a, you know, I worked it and I wrapped it, but you need to take these animals. She said, well, we're not here for that. I said, I don't give a frick what you're here for. And she looks at the cops. You know, they turn their back on her. That, because he knew what I'd been through. He turned his back on her. She said, fine, show us where these other animals are first, and then let's look at your animals. So I rode my motorcycle. They followed me in this truck, and we went to the place where there, I mean, it was a beach house. It was non-existent. There were no houses there anymore. There were barely any scraps of wood, you know, where there were piles closer in. There was nothing there. They said, okay. They looked, and then I took them, and it was funny because my motorcycle can go over everything, but this truck couldn't, so it took them forever. They went from place to place picking up animals for me. The deal is, they never touched any of them. I got the animals. They got a crate out. I went and got the animals and put them in for them. We went to the next place. They never touched them. They got the crate out. I took the animals, put them in for them. I was so pissed off because there were so many animals that really, if these were really vets, not duded up assistants or whatever they were, but they would have, you know, looked at the animals that I thought were in almost critical shape, but they didn't. That's the FEMA that I encountered. The only other time I saw anything about FEMA, and I hate to keep bagging on FEMA, but
no, a lot of people have issues with them. A lot of people have issues with the way they handle things.
9 months later, I was there right before the next season, hurricane season, and over at emergency communities, and they were right down the street. Well, we drove over because we needed something from them, and they were taking down their tent. FEMA wasn't there. The trailer was locked up, and they were taking down the big tent. So I asked the guys taking down the tent, what's up with, are you guys moving? He said, oh, we're leaving because, you know, it's almost hurricane season. I thought, are you kidding me? The hell's wrong with you people? This is what you do. This is what you're here for. I'm not saying stand here and weather a hurricane, but there was no hurricane in sight. So I'm a little frustrated with that. I also wrote an open letter you'll find on the web.
God help us all.
Oh, yeah. Because the helicopters it's in the letter, probably sixth or seventh day. The helicopters are going past, but nobody's stopping. You know, if the president and all these people viewing from above and complaining about what's your fault, it's your fault. Well, this levee, that levee, who gives a shit? Get in there, get your boots on, get a shovel, and help people out. That was what we really needed. Down in the Ninth Ward, there were tour buses coming through months later.
That's
tour
obnoxious.
Buses. Church tour buses. And the people were looking. They never stepped off the bus. There were people there trying to go through their homes and find what they could. If one person would get off that tour bus and help that one guy, and the other guys would get off and help one guy, whatever it is they were doing, you know, looking for stuff, cleaning up stuff, whatever, this thing would get saddled, but they didn't. They were viewers. It was like a movie for them. And that frustrated the crap out of me.
What happened with regard to water delivery and, you know, how people can go days without eating or they can eat very little or have scraps, but they can't do that with water and hydration. What happened with water and how was it delivered?
Well, the truth is, I can't tell you because I don't know. You know, in the past, the military brought water, and there were very few people still there. But the people there were, they supplied them with food and water, MREs. Everybody got MREs. And it's a meal ready-made or something like that, or ready to eat, I guess is what it is. But there was, I had water. I got it from where the military was. And by the time I got down to emergency communities, they, too, had these trucks already installed there with water and food.
Who sets up the emergency communities? Is it something that just kind of comes together organically, or what is it?
Yeah, emergency communities was actually a group of people. What happened was, for me, when I was finished with my work in the past, I went online and saw that this group was there. And actually started talking to a friend of mine who was there working with them. And another friend of mine who's actually a chef in Santa Monica, he was there cooking the meals. So I just went over to where they were and hooked up with them.
Did you see a lot of blankets being delivered, or people tend to, in disasters, need blankets?
They need blankets. Yeah. They need shoes. They need, how do you say this delicately? A lot of people had like athlete's foot and crotch rot.
Yeah.
Okay. Those sort of things. We had a lot of that. Emergency communities had a lot of, you know, again, we would wash their clothes. We had showers. We had these sun showers set up. So the people, again, they would come in if they could. And if we couldn't, I gave a lot of people a lot of rides. If I found somebody in my area where I was hanging out and working, I would just take them over. And again, they could take a shower, get some new clothes, get fed 3 meals a day. And they would come, they'd hang, and then we would take them back. There were people living on their porches with tarps over them and sleeping there. I think mostly they were afraid to leave their homes because they were afraid that somebody would take their stuff or, you know, mess with their stuff, what was left. But that, I didn't see that as an issue. You would hear about it on the news. You know, the news is really great at making Americans afraid of Americans, which is a huge, you know.
It's an opportunity for a disconnect instead of a connect.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Things tend to be focused on in the news that expand and escalate.
Oh, they like to get you angry and excited.
You know? Yeah.
You know, but the truth is that wasn't the reality of what I dealt with down there. It was people helping people.
When did you know it was time for you to pack up and go back home?
No, there wasn't a time. What happened was once you've done the emergency stuff, then really people need other people with an outside perspective to tell them it's okay, that it's going to be okay, that it's going to change, that the whole world didn't collapse, just this small area. Because that to remind them that this is just this for the moment, that it's going to get better. This isn't out there. You know, the world is still churning. Because I noticed that the people that had gone through this, they thought the entire world was gone. And for them, it kind of was. But hope. All these people, that's what the groups that came from outside to help, they brought hope. They reminded them that everything's going to be okay. I saw that in huge numbers with the massages they were giving. They'd sit and talk with these people. And we're talking about hippies from California, you know, or different places. But for me, it was all these California kids. What I did was I left in October. I saw online. This is so odd. You're going to think I'm a crazy person, but I saw online that. I thought I'd go up to New York because when I have a lot of friends up there, a lot of Harley, you know, I ride a Harley and I'm involved with a lot of Harley groups, but, I had some friends up there that were bikers. And what I did is I went to, Long Island. If you go on Craigslist on Long Island, people at 60,000 miles, they sell their cars cheaply because 60,000 miles on Long Island is a lot of miles, you know, and it's a lot of years to take. It takes them a lot of years to get 60,000 miles on a car on Long Island. Here in LA, it's a whole nother thing. But I went to Long Island. The first car I bought was an Isuzu Trooper. And so I bought it for $750. That was the most expensive car I bought. I bought a little, I don't know, Saturn something for $327. It didn't back up. But I took it over to the guys. Wait. I took it to the guys and they fixed it. Everything I bought was fixed by the guy, by this group of Harley riders. And I drove it down, hitting garage sales all the way down. I got shoes. I got blankets. People gave them to me for free. I didn't buy anything. I would stop at a garage sale and I'd say, I'm going down to New Orleans. And could I have these blankets? Could I have these shoes? Whatever they needed, not tchotchkes, not crap, but the things that I knew that they needed from being down there. And I would take it, I would give the car away and take JetBlue, fly back up, buy another car. And I did that all winter.
That's amazing.
The people in, and I think I spent it the most. And I didn't pay for the parts or anything. I just bought the initial car, right? I think I spent, let me figure this out. less than $4,000 on 7 cars.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's an amazing
And most of them
feat.
Just needed brakes, or one needed a water pump. One was, I don't know, something, but the guys did it. They took care of it. And then I came back with a load of stuff.
Amazing.
And what made me do this, there was this girl named Debbie. I don't know who she is. She was this wonderful little darling girl, older woman. She wasn't a girl, but she was small. And she was living on her porch. And she asked me if she could have a ride from the feeding center at Emergency Communities back to where she lived. But she didn't want to show me where she lived because she lived on her porch. And she was embarrassed. And she said to me, I wish I had a car. You know, I could just live in that. And I said, you know, do you have a driver's license? She said, oh, yes. But I have, you know, my car floated away and I'm living on my porch. So I don't want you to see, but just you can just drop me at the corner. And then when she got out, she said, you know, today's my birthday. And then she slammed the door. I was so touched by that. Anyhow, I went and I bought her a pack of cigarettes because I didn't know what else I could give her. You know what I mean? And that was the first person I thought if I could just get her a car. So I started looking on Craigslist because, you know, we do it all the time in LA, Craigslist. Maybe it's, I know it's becoming worldwide, but and it was in Long Island and it was cheap. And I thought, are you kidding me? She could live in this. Cause I used to drive a van. I'd be driving all over the rodeos and stuff when I was a kid. And, in my van, me and my dog, my saddle. So, oh, geez. Anyhow. So yeah, that's kind of what started the whole thing.
That's pretty touching. Yeah. That's pretty touching. If you had a chance to say a part about what people need to know about how to be supportive in disasters that are happening on the earth, or recommendations and wisdom from the ground, what would you say?
I would say that just go
there
do
will
it.
Be more.
Yeah,
there will be more.
Just go do it. There's a time when you need to listen. You know, it's twofold. Here's the deal. The more hands, the more care that you give each individual person, don't look at it as this humongous disaster. You have to, as an individual, go find the first person you can help. And that will instill this faith in them that it's going to be okay. And they work even harder and they get their stuff done and they have a partner, because people are meant to be partnered, I believe. It's so much easier when you have somebody throwing in. Now, if you listen to the news, you don't go down to the Ninth Ward. You could catch something. Oh, my God, there's this in the water and that in the water. And stop listening to people that make Americans afraid of Americans, because that's happening more and more here. And it just destroys the fabric of what America's about.
And also what humanity's about.
Okay. What humanity's about. Yeah, absolutely. I refuse to let that stop me. I absolutely refuse to let anybody make me afraid of other people. Are there bad guys in the world? Absolutely. And do you listen to your gut and take a step back when you encounter one? Of course. But the regular guy on the street, the regular American that we were brought up to believe is what our country's about, they're there all over the place.
That's awesome. That's really inspiring. Talk about Road to Sturgis. Fill us in. What is this 10,000-mile motorcycle ride? What the heck are you doing in April?
Well, I'm a filmmaker. I am directing a film called Road to Sturgis. And it is it's a film about a woman biker and how she learns that the world isn't such a bad place by hooking up with bikers. Because, you know, bikers are the blue-collar, regular working man. That's what they are. There's no mystery here. You know, it isn't. There are a few bad apples, like in anything. There are bad cops, and I love cops. There are bad military. Love military, because I grew up in a military household. And there are bad bikers. And then there's everybody else that absolutely enjoy this lifestyle, this freedom, this protect your back, but protect your brother's back harder. You know, it's almost because the Hell's Angels, for example, was actually started by a bunch of military, ex-military guys.
That's interesting. I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And there's an absolute honor among these people. The same honor that you find in our regular farm communities or through the Midwest.
Midwest, I was going to say.
The Middle East. In the Farm Belt communities, because I was born in South Dakota, and I'm related to, I think, everybody in South Dakota. But
that's a big family, Allie.
Yeah, I know
it's a big family.
You're telling me Christmas is hell. But there's a real red, white, and blue blooded part of humanity that I think is the fabric of this country, and that encompasses a lot of bikers. And so I am doing one woman, one motorcycle, 10,000 miles around the country, interviewing people, meeting people. We're going to talk to people that build bikes, but we're going to go back to New Orleans and to the pass, talk to those people. I have a lot of footage nobody's seen.
Can't wait till that's available to people.
Yeah.
I think people would love to see your shots,
I want to see what it looks like now compared to, the same community, the same corner, the same houses, what it looks like now.
I'll bet you have a lot of people that love you in New Orleans.
Yes, I do. And they call constantly.
That's great.
I've been back a few times. I've been in 06, obviously, when I was doing the cars. 07, I was there. And then actually last year, I dropped by. So every time because I love to ride, I'm making my trek across the country constantly. But it's to promote the film. Yeah, it's to promote the film and build an audience for it using social networking. So by the time we actually shoot this film, everybody will be invested in it. And by the time we put it out, we'll have an audience. Not that we won't in the first place, but
it's an organic process.
It is. Mm-hmm. It really is. And I don't know that studios are interested in funding a biker film. This is a Easy Rider versus Thelma and Louise film. It is, and it's fabulous. But it is the real of what bikers are. It's not, and God bless them, but it is not Sons of Anarchy, because
I never saw that. But.
Well, Sons of Anarchy is a television show, but the truth is, in a biker club, it's just like in the military. You protect your brother. It's not about some soap opera where they're all against each other in a club, because if they were backstabbing each other in a club like that, they'd all have been dead a long time ago. It's not Wild Hogs, which was funny. I loved it. Not about bikers.
I'm getting closer to my sense of what it is. And I'm sure that it'll morph, too, as it gets going.
Sure.
I think there's going to be some surprises for you, even.
Sure. Listen, my mother is 72. That woman still rides a bike. And when I go visit, my dad does too, but they have their own bikes. She doesn't ride on the back. And when we were young, my mother would not let us ride on the back. Get your own bike. You ride your own bike. If you're going to kill yourself, you're going to kill yourself, not some guy, right? So, So when I'm my parents live in Western Kentucky now. And so when I go there, my mother gets out her bike, my dad gets out his bike, we go driving around. Well, my mother pulls her helmet off, because my mother's, she's a 72-year-old, gray-haired, little sweet-faced, apple-cheeked lady. People give us a second look, and it's like she draws a crowd. Oh my gosh, da-da-da-da-da, you ride that by yourself? She says, I don't see anybody else on his bike. She's darling. So
sweet. That's great. Talk to us a little bit about Peacekeepers. I just thought the audience should know a little bit about it.
Peacekeepers is a film that I'm shooting in. It's about the Congo, the real of what's going on in the Congo. Not tribal wars. It is not what's going on in the Congo. The Congo is actually, it's almost like the Old West, the race for the gold. Well, in the Congo, there are people in other countries, which are Rwanda and Uganda, that actually go into the Congo and mine there, or they've enslaved the people of the Congo to mine the things that Western civilization is using, coltan for our phones and our computers, any of the metals that come out of there. They're actually being mined by the enslaved people of the Congo, and then depending on what area controls it, Rwanda or Uganda, the materials will be then shipped out through those countries, sold from those countries to Japan, the UK, us, all the people that you know, it's almost like, let me give you what I think it's like. It's like if Canada came here and all the rights and all of the material and all of the what's the term?
Minerals.
Well, the minerals, but all the assets.
Resources.
The resources. All of the resources of this country are then sold from Canada to other countries to use. And the people here
don't have access to them and the pleasures and benefits of them.
That's exactly right. Yeah, that's exactly what's going on in the Congo. And unfortunately, it's not people that we don't know. It's not strangers. You know, it's very well thought of, very rich organizations.
It's the cartel. Companies. Let's be straight. Well, it's the cartel. The cartel that's in these countries that is not allowing the people of the Congo to have access, usage, and prosperity from its own resources.
Yeah,
That's the threat of it. But your movie in particular is to capture what?
Is to explain this to people. It's Blood Diamond mixed with Born Identity, kind of a feel to it. You know, thank God for Blood Diamond, because then De Beers was sued after that. You know, De Beers used to have, I don't remember if it's 85 or 90% of the diamond industry. And if you, diamonds are not rare by any means. What they did for many years is they would purchase the diamonds from other companies and then just dole them out and make you think they were incredibly rare. They're not. So after Blood Diamond came out, De Beers was sued and are required to pay back, I believe it's 30% of your purchase price. If you, I can't remember how many years, but if you've purchased a diamond in the last 30 or 40 years, and obviously you'd have to have some sort of paperwork, but you could get back part of your purchase price. And they're also setting up, you know, little organization. What's the word? NGOs.
Lobbying organizations or NGOs?
Yeah. For the people of the communities that they've harmed. I think they've harmed them.
I'd imagine that's a sensitive and very delicate motion picture to make. It will require financing from people that not only have the financing, but who want to make a social difference through the financing.
Who aren't afraid of Bank of America, who aren't afraid of De Beers. Let's just name names, okay?
I think that the weight of to finance this is on a broad spectrum, number one, but also if on a parallel level it's happened on a traditional level, that the funders should actually sign an agreement to be anonymous, actually. And there's nothing wrong with that, actually, so that the work can get done. And sometimes that's important to get certain messages and bodies of work done with the least amount of interference.
Yes.
So if you're out there, ladies and gentlemen, and you're interested in getting something tastefully and beautifully done that needs to get done regarding peacekeepers and or would like to be involved in supporting Rhoda Sturgis,
and
please contact Ali Star.
Peacekeepers is not a documentary. It is.
Right, it's a motion picture.
Yes, it is.
How do people get a hold of you?
They can come knock on my door.
RhodaSturgis.com?
Sorry.
RhodaSturgis.com?
RhodaSturgis.net. Yes.
I stand corrected with the net. Ladies and gentlemen, we have been talking to Alistar McKenna, producer, director, writer of Peacekeepers, the film, and doing a live documentary and actually 10,000-mile adventure called Road to Sturgis.
Follow me on Road to Sturgis. You can, if you go to roadtosturgis.net, you can follow me. I have a GPS on my tail end. And if you want to ride, if you're a rider, you can jump right in and ride with me some miles. Or throw a party for me wherever I go. You can find out. You'll have a map there of where I'm going to be.
I really want to thank you for being on the show and sharing about 5 days after Katrina, your experience, and sharing with us a deep part of who you are and your contribution. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's Rainmaking Time.